My guest is one of Broadway's great lyricists, Sheldon Harnick. With his former collaborator, Jerry Bock, Harnick wrote the songs for Fiddler on the Roof, Fiorello, She Loves Me, Tenderloin, and The Apple Tree. Harnick and Bock ended their partnership in 1970 after their musical The Rothschilds. It's been over 10 years since Harnick had a new Broadway musical. His last one, Rex, was written with composer Richard Rodgers. In the past few years, Harnick has translated several operettas into English, including The Merry Widow. He's also working on a one-act opera in collaboration with composer Jonathan Tunick, and a musical version of It's a Wonderful Life, which Harnick hopes will open on Broadway after some legal problems are ironed out. Of all his musicals, one of Harnick's favorites is She Loves Me. It opened in April of 1963 and closed 8.5 months later. Now the Opera Ensemble of New York will stage a production of She Loves Me in early May. The original cast recording, which has been long out of print, was recently reissued on CD by Polydor.
She loves me, and to my amazement, I love it, knowing that she loves me. She loves me, true, she doesn't show it. How could she, when she doesn't know it? Yesterday she loathed me, bah, now today she likes me, ha! And tomorrow, tomorrow, ah, my teeth ache from the urge to touch her. I'm speechless, for I mustn't tell her. It's wrong now, but it won't be long now before my love discovers that she and I are lovers. Imagine how surprised she's bound to be. She loves me. She loves me.
Sheldon Harnick, welcome to Fresh Air. Is this very good news for you that She Loves Me has been reissued? Are you glad to see it back in print again?
Oh, it certainly is, because along with Fiddler on the Roof, I think it's the favorite show that I've ever been connected with.
It closed after a little over 300 performances.
That's correct.
On Broadway. The liner notes were written by the producer of this reissue, Larry Lash, and he implies that audiences really wanted brassier entertainment than She Loves Me at the time that it opened on Broadway. What was the context that it opened in?
The context meaning other shows?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, it was 1963. Oh, I don't remember what the other shows were. But I think it's true that She Loves Me is a very literate, rather gentle show. And as some people have called it, caviar. It seemed at the time to have a limited audience that... As a matter of fact, when it closed, I was quite distressed because I loved the show so. And for about 2 years, if I remember correctly, it seemed to be dead, which was both bewildering and depressing. But through the years, it got performances, and I began to get letters. Jerry Bock and I both got letters from companies who performed it saying, we love the show, we love to perform it, and that was gratifying. And over the years, little by little, it's made its way into the mainstream of shows that get performed.
Let me ask you a couple of things about the title song that we just heard.
Mm-hmm.
The initial rhymes are really repetitions. She loves me, but she doesn't know it. No, she loves me, but she doesn't show it. How could she when she doesn't know it?
Mm-hmm.
What goes through your mind when you're using, say, two its instead of rhyming an it with a sit or an it with a bit, but to reuse that word?
Oh, that's a different kind of rhyme. The rhyme is not it. If you'll notice, the accent is on the prior syllable. Show it, know it, and that's done all the time. If it were one word, it would be like action, faction.
Mm-hmm.
So that the rhyme is not necessarily on the last syllable. It's where the stress is, and in those cases, the stress is on show and on know.
I like the line, my teeth ache from the urge to touch her.
Well, that's an extremely personal line. I was trying to use myself as George, and I realized that there are situations with some women where whatever the feelings are, they get me right in the back of the teeth. Now, I had a friend who... not having had that experience, he said, what kind of a line is that? He said, I love you, and my foot hurts, you know. So it was very personal to me, and I just hoped that other people either would identify with it or at least understand what I was saying.
I want to play the opening number, that you wrote the lyrics for She Loves Me. This is called Good Morning, Good Day. But before we hear it, I'd like you to talk a little bit about the function that this song had to serve within the play, because opening numbers are really important. They have to set the tone for everything that's going to follow, and they frequently have to introduce the characters as well.
Right.
What are some of the functions this song had to play when you were writing it?
Well, I guess the main thing that the song did was to set the tone of the show. And for good or for bad, it's a gentle tone. It's not a razzle-dazzle opening number. Also, the number lyrics and music interweave with some of Joe Mastaroff's dialogue. So it was really a delineation of character at the top of the show, the people we were going to be spending the next 2 hours with. And mostly it was that. It was getting you to know them, getting you to get a sense of the fact that they're comrades in this shop that they all work in.
Okay, let's hear a part of Good Morning, Good Day with the lyrics by my guest Sheldon Harnick.
Good morning.
Good day.
How are you this beautiful day? Isn't this a beautiful morning?
Very.
Hey, see, boss, how's this?
That's a very elegant pose, but is all that elegance necessary?
And why not? I represent Marichex, don't I? We're not a butcher shop or a hardware store. We're a parfumery. And that means we're
stylish.
That's it.
With a quiet dignity.
Yes. And we get the tilt of our hats right.
That's right.
When I ride my bike, people see what Marichex like. So I think it's very important that I look my best. Here comes Miss Ritter.
Miss Ritter.
Good morning.
Good day.
How are you this glorious day? Have you seen a lovelier morning?
Never.
It's too nice a day to be inside shuffling soap. I have no more energy whatsoever. Does anybody mind if I take the day off? Arpad, why aren't you old enough to take me away from all this?
I'm old enough.
Then marry me.
You know, listening to that, it's easy for me to understand why you're doing operettas now and one-act operas. I seem to hear a connection between some of the writing that you did for She Loves Me.
Right. I'm sure I wasn't aware of it at the time, but I think I was leaning towards that kind of through-composed style where it would be either sung all the way through or a mix of music and dialogue that totaled up to almost a complete musical experience.
When you're writing a lyric, do you find that you frequently throw out the first few versions of it before you come up with the one you like, or are you lucky enough to hit on it the first time?
Well, what I find, funny you should say that, I haven't thought about this for a while, but what I find is quite often the first version of a lyric, it's not that the lyric won't be technically good, and the idea may even be good, but what I find is I don't know the character well enough yet, so that as my acquaintance with the character deepens, then I will look at that lyric and no longer be satisfied with it and think, no, that's really not what the character would say at this time, so that I throw it out and start over again. And if I'm lucky, I'm able to salvage some of the better lines from the song.
Do you allow yourself to use the same rhyme twice in different songs?
I'm not entirely sure I know what you mean.
Say you used a rhyme 15 years ago in a song.
Oh.
And those particular words will work just fine in a song you're working on now. Will you rule it out because you already used it once?
If it's a trick rhyme, yeah, I'll rule it out. I try and avoid that. Sometimes, of course, you don't remember. What's more difficult, I once asked Ogden Nash, a man I loved, and I loved his work. I was his assistant for a television show years ago called Art Carney Meets Peter and the Wolf, so I got to meet him and work with him. And I said, what happened? Well, how do you feel if you write a rhyme that you feel is original with you, and then you hear another song, an earlier song, where that rhyme has been used? Do you have to go back and rewrite? And Ogden started laughing. He said, oh my, he said, I write rhymes and I'm so proud of myself. I think they're fresh and new. And then I find out that Larry Hart wrote them 20 years ago. And he said, all I can tell you is if you feel that you've created that rhyme, then use it. He said, there's no reason to change it just because someone else has. And as a matter of fact, I've started reading poetry late in my life, in the last 8 years or so, I've been going through poetry. And I find with Browning and with Lowell and people like that, they've used all of those complicated rhymes a century before we did.
And that doesn't bother you, though?
No.
What are you learning from reading poetry that applies to songs?
I think what I'm learning is that the great poets, not even the great poets, the minor poets, all good poets, have a genuine care for using the right word in the right place. I think that comes through, and it makes you want to, it inspires you to do the same, to be careful, to write with as great care as possible so that you really express what it is that you yourself are feeling.
You never write pop songs, at least not that I know of. All of your songs are written in the context of a show.
Right. I learned very early that that was not my talent. I was quite disappointed when I discovered that, because when I came to New York from Chicago, it was with the idea of being another Irving Berlin, writing for the theater and having songs come out of it that were pop hits. And little by little, as I talked to people and as I looked around and as I was honest with myself, I thought, no, that's not the way I write. So I was hoping that ultimately some of the songs from the shows would become standards, and that's what happened. There's been a few.
Well, what did make you realize that your gift was for writing songs within shows and not just pop songs?
Well, I think there were two experiences, I think. One, I hadn't been in New York too long when I had four songs in an off-Broadway review called the Shoestring Review, and they got very nice press. So I was invited up to meet a publisher in the pop field, and I played him my stuff. And after I did, they said, well, your work is too filled with ideas. It's not simple enough for what we want is something much simpler. And I thought, I guess that's true, but I write complicated most of the time, or at least I do try and put ideas in. And I thought, well, if that's the case, that's the case. Then the other experience was, after I had met Jerry Bock and we started to work together, there was a period when we didn't particularly have a show to work on, so we worked on a lot of what were meant to be pop songs, and we didn't sell any of them. And at a certain point, we looked at each other and thought, well, that's not what we do.
Mm-hmm. Before you started working with composer Jerry Bock, you were writing music for your own songs, and I think it was Yip Harburg, the lyricist who's probably best known for writing lyrics to The Wizard of Oz, who told you to stick to lyrics. Was that good advice?
Yes. Well, it certainly facilitated my career. What he did was to tell me that, in his estimation at that time, this was the early 50s, that there were more capable theater composers than there were capable theater lyricists. So what he actually said was, if you can facilitate your career by agreeing to collaborate with other composers instead of writing music yourself. And that's what I did. Shortly before he died, as a matter of fact, he told a good friend of mine, Madeline Guilford, who was a very close friend of his, my name came up in a conversation they were having, and Yip said, I wonder if I did that young man a disservice. He said his music was fine, but I wanted him to get ahead faster, so I wanted him to work with other people, and I hope I didn't steer him away from writing his own music.
I think one of the things that would be really nice about writing lyrics to somebody else's music is that you've got a variety of lines to write to. That you've got, if the music's coming first, you have somebody else's lines to fit your words and rhymes to, and that there'd be less of a possibility of getting stuck or of rewriting the same song.
Well, there's always the possibility of getting stuck, but What is wonderful about writing with someone else, there's two things that come to mind. One is that music, although people consider it as an abstract art form, music to me is very concrete. Music says certain things, so that when I hear a piece of music, when Jerry used to give me a tape with a lot of new music on it, music suggests ideas, music suggests emotions and moods, and I would find myself getting ideas for lyrics that I wouldn't have had if I hadn't heard those pieces of music. So that was wonderful. The other thing is, as you were implying, one of the difficult things to create in writing a lyric is the form of the lyric, or at least it's difficult for me. Maybe other people don't have that problem. But to create a fresh form is not always easy. And when someone gives you a piece of music, the form is there. So you don't have to worry about that. All you have to worry about is the other things, singability and clarity and rhyme and things like that.
Stephen Sondheim, back at his lecture on lyrics that he gave at the New York Y years ago, this was in the 1970s, said that you were one of his favorite lyricists and that he liked your work for its grace, its charm, and its perfection of setting. And I think that perfection of setting has really been an important one for you. And I think of the different kinds of settings you've had to write for: Fiorello, which is about New York politics; Fiddler on the Roof, which is set in an Eastern European shtetl. I mean, those are two really different extremes that you had to write lyrics for.
Mm-hmm. I do my research, and as a matter of fact, I think that accounts for the least successful show that I did.
Which one?
The first one with Jerry Bock. It was called The Body Beautiful. And I accepted the show because I was very hungry to get a show on Broadway, but it was not the show I should have done. It was about boxing. And boxing was a sport and a milieu that I really had almost no interest in. So although I did my research, my heart wasn't in it.
Well, Fiddler on the Roof, which was a very unusual setting, the Eastern European shtetl, was one of your most successful shows, one of the most successful shows on Broadway, probably. This was one of the shows that you initiated the idea for.
Right. A friend had sent me a novel by Shalom Aleichem, a book called Wandering Star, about a Yiddish theatrical troupe touring all over Russia and Poland. And I loved it. I gave it to Jerry Bock to read. He loved it. And we gave it to Joe Stein to read. Joe read it, and he said, it's too sprawling. It covers 40 years. It has a cast. I mean, it has about 80 characters. It's just too big. He said, but the writing is wonderful, and it's very inherently musical. Why don't we look for more things by Shalom Aleichem? So we did, and we found the Tevye stories, which we then optioned and began the project ourselves.
Well, we were talking before about songs that do and don't have lives outside of the show, and you said you always wanted to write songs that would have a life outside of the show. I think the songs in Fiddler on the Roof certainly did, and I think especially of Sunrise Sunset, about how many weddings that
right.
song has been sung at. Have you been to weddings where they sang that song?
I've not only been to weddings where they've sung that song, but I have a number of friends who've asked me and my wife to sing that song. For instance, Alan Alda's daughter got married, and one of his daughters got married, and Margie and I sang there. So we've sung the song ourselves at a number of weddings.
Can I ask you to recite the lyrics from the song?
Or the opening. I think I can remember the first chorus anyway.
Okay.
Is this the little girl I carried? Is this the little boy at play? I don't remember growing older. When did they? When did she get to be a beauty? When did he grow to be so tall? Wasn't it yesterday that they were small? Sunrise, sunset, sunrise, sunset, swiftly flow the days. Seedlings turn overnight to sunflowers, blossoming even as we gaze. Sunrise, sunset, swiftly fly the years, one season following another, laden with happiness and tears.
What came first in that song when you were writing it?
The music. And I remember it very vividly. Jerry Bock was living in New Rochelle at the time, and I would take the train out there. We would go into his basement where he had a studio. And he played me the music for Sunrise Sunset. And I was so moved by it. I had the experience of having, I've used this phrase describing this experience before, I had the experience of having lyrics kind of crystallize on the notes. It came out very fast, very rapidly. And we were both so thrilled with it that we called Jerry's wife, Patty. We said, come down, come down. She ran down to the basement, and we played it, and she wept.
That was a good sign, huh?
Yes.
Did you learn about writing songs in settings by some of the early work that you did for industries? You wrote a lot of industrial shows, I think, for places like Esso and Nabisco, Buick. What did you write songs for them?
They had an interesting policy. They used standard music. My job was to take the material they did, the points they wanted to make. Most of the shows I did were for salesmen, either introducing a new product or a new slogan or just making them more enthusiastic about what they were doing. So that my job was fitting this material into existing music. They felt that it was enough to give their audiences the message without asking them to absorb new melodies as well. And as a matter of fact, later they got sued for this because I didn't know at the time that they hadn't been they hadn't been paying the composers. As a matter of fact, I did a long lyric to the Meredith Willson's song "Trouble," and somebody who was in the industrial show that we did was a friend of Meredith Willson's, and he called Meredith Willson not to complain, but just to say what fun it was doing this new lyric to Meredith Willson's tune. And Willson, of course, was shocked. He said, "What do you mean? Nobody asked me for my permission." But what that experience did for me was to refine my craft, because especially for an industrial show, everything had to be done with the greatest possible clarity, the greatest possible economy, and the greatest possible effectiveness. So it was learning to hone my skills.
Do you remember any of the lyrics you wrote for those industrials?
Oh, no, that was...
too long ago. Huh?
That's too long ago. That's about 30 years ago.
When you're looking at a book that you're going to be writing the lyrics for, how do you know where the songs go? What makes the place in a Broadway book for a song?
Well, there can be a number of different places. One, of course, which we're all taught, is that one looks for the emotional high point of the scene, where the emotion is so strong that the words want to start soaring. Instead of just being spoken, you want the addition of music to deepen the emotion. But also, there can be a spot, for instance, in Fiorello. As Jerome Wideman wrote the book, he had a scene in a political clubhouse where the men were playing poker. And I thought, oh my, I played a lot of poker in the Army, and I remembered a lot of the colorful lingo that went with poker, and I thought, I want to use that lingo for a colorful lyric. So I spoke to Jerome Wideman, and I said, I want to borrow some of your lines, and I want to change a large part of this poker game into music. And he said, be my guest. He was very generous, so I did that.
You remember any of the lyric?
Oh,
this is politics and poker.
This is politics
about, right?
And politics and poker. Well, the first part was all that King Betts. I panic whenever anybody asks me to remember one of my lyrics. But it's
feel like an imposter when that happens.
They'll see right through me. They'll see that I have this small boy who comes in and does all my lyrics for me.
You're working on a lot of new projects now.
Yeah.
Would you tell us about one of them, the one that you're really looking forward to?
I have no favorites.
Okay. One
of the ones that the most frustrating, with composer Joe Raposo, we did an adaptation of the old film It's a Wonderful Life. And what we did everything we were supposed to do, our producers did. They did a copyright search. And we discovered later that there were very bizarre copyright problems, problems that none of us expected. And so we're still trying to iron those out. I hope we'll iron them out soon, because we've tried the show at the University of Michigan where it went wonderfully well. It's ready for Broadway, and if we can just clear up those problems, we'll have, I think, a wonderful show to bring in.
How have things changed in terms of trying out a show before bringing it to Broadway?
Well, it's just so costly to take a show on the road. It may add, I don't know, maybe another $1 million to the budget. It's just everything costs so much. Traveling, transportation, the cost of the musicians, the cost of the actors, the per diems on the road, everything just costs so much that, as we've seen, shows arrive now from England where they're tried out. Of course, the English don't consider it a tryout. They consider it their theater. But in many ways, our producers consider it a tryout, that it's much cheaper to mount a show over there. And so if something is a hit, then they risk bringing it in. Otherwise, shows tend to arise in other cities around this country, and then a producer will get to see them and then, again, risk bringing them in. There are fewer and fewer shows that seem to originate on Broadway, which is a shame.
Do you miss Broadway when you don't have a show that's open there?
Well, there's two things about Broadway that no other venue can provide. One is the immediate launching of a show. When you do a show on Broadway, even a flop people know about it all over the country. And if it's a hit, they may know about it all over the world. Whereas if you start a show that's a success in some other city, little by little, it has to make its way into the news and it has to make its way into the stream of things that get produced. And then, of course, for a writer, the other thing is that the money that comes in for a Broadway success is enough to enable you to devote your life to writing. If you don't have that kind of royalty coming in, then you have to teach or you have to find another profession that'll support you to support your writing habit.
You haven't had to do that, have you?
Not since Fiorello.
Right, which was a long time ago.
Yeah.
One last question. When you're writing lyrics for a song, where are you? At the piano, at the desk, on the couch, driving in the car?
I'm various places. Where I prefer to be when I start is in a reclining chair. And on a little end table next to the chair is my thesaurus and my rhyming dictionary if I need them. But I like to be quiet and calm and just in a position to think and hoping that the phone won't ring because I'm a compulsive answerer. Then, once the lyric is started and it reaches a point where I'm excited about what I'm doing, then it can be on a subway, on a train, walking around the city. In fact, I have to be careful that I don't walk right on into traffic.
I thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you.
Well, thank you for having me.